This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
So many of you joined the meditation session this morning, and I was wondering if you could just call out what draws you to meditation, what decided you this morning to spend the morning meditating. What is it for you that you are curious about it, any questions about it, or just wondering what is it that you want to spend some time doing this? Want to just say, anybody? Jess?
Had something to say when I actually volunteered.
Okay, somebody else can go.
I guess like just the path towards realizing self is like it's more than just what I originally thought, which was more for peace of mind, which is always that. But now that I'm a little bit farther on a pretty short path, maybe it's more about realizing self at this point. And then letting self go eventually.
Thanks. Thanks. Somebody else? Yeah.
I find that I often have to continuously ask and re-ask myself while I'm sitting, why am I doing this? And not in a, sometimes, but. and I had just a wonderful moment where just mindful of breathing, okay, I'm just going to sit and look at this confusion that's arising. And then I thought, how wonderful, we're all sitting here more or less looking at our confusion and our whatever's arising that we're trying to see through, and we're basically all doing it for each other. So okay, great.
Thank you so much. It's beautiful. Yeah, Shishin, why are you sitting?
Yes, I'm sitting because it helps bring me equanimity. And I'm, as you may know, dealing with a lot of difficulty, and it helps bring peace to that difficulty.
Thank you. Thanks for sharing. So bringing peace, yeah, Doris?
I also came for the community and to practice going within, which I don't really do. So I thought this would encourage me to go within.
To go within? Like that, thank you. Words of what draws you to sitting this morning? Yeah.
I'm always surprised to find how creative I am in meditation. Like, it seems like I'm forever conjuring stuff up and making stuff and trying to release it too, but the engine of self-making, I guess you'd say, or I would say almost creativity, because I guess we construct the self, and then when we sit down, we notice how the construction process, at least. Mm-hmm. I'm always surprised to see, wow, I'm really busy in there.
Thank you. Who is it the first time sitting today? Okay. So you're very fortunate right now, having heard already some voices of people who have been sitting for a while and getting some insight. So there was a sense of wanting to turn inward, wanting to understand oneself, wanting to find more calm, going inward. And it seems that's what meditation ultimately promises, just, you know, dropping our calendar of activities for, you know, 40 minutes this half morning, and really taking the time to look at your mind. And for you, some of you who have maybe had meditation instructions, you heard some of the methods that, you know, are out there and very common of how to look at your mind, which is, you know, you first stabilize it through a calmness, through, you know, turning off your devices, having just a quiet place, following your breath, and then slowly your mind is doing, and slowly over periods of sitting, you see, oh, I'm really caught up with this topic, or I'm really caught up with this aspect of my life. And then over time, you're noticing, oh, these are patterns that I'm seeing within myself. I keep being caught up in the same pattern. And once you realize more and more patterns about yourself, those patterns become lighter. There's some kind of spaciousness that grows around these because you're familiarizing yourself with your own thought patterns, your own emotional kind of entanglements or connections or makeups, how you're being made up. Light louder, thank you. So meditation, this is incredible way of learning about yourself, learning about your mind, and finding a way to like stop this in your life. Like Kōpon Shinroshi, who has been founding this temple, he famously said something to the effect, if your life is really complicated, or it's really important, you have a lot of important responsibilities, you naturally want to sit down a little bit. Like, it's so important and it's so complicated, you naturally want to just take a step back and be really careful with what's going on. But in order to distinguish of what one of the, some of the more senior meditators here already voiced about, you know, the letting go aspect, just to be more clear on that, I just want to highlight a few ways of how not to meditate. And these are natural things you might do in the beginning, but just to like point them out. For example, in this culture, there's a lot of emphasis on consuming, yeah? Like, so if you need something, you go out, get a tool, or you need, you go out, get an appointment or something in order to help yourself. So it's very much encouraged to that behavior. And so one actually maybe has a sense, for example, if I went to the doctor a few times and they told me, you know, are you meditating? Because that's really good for your health. So like meditation is kind of part in this culture now, very commonly thought as something on the medicine shelf. You know, it really helps your mind, it helps your psychology in some way. However, as some of my teachers pointed out, you know, there are other ways to do it that are less painful. You know, like you can go get a massage, you know, it gets you relaxed. You can go into sensory deprivation tank, you come out really relaxed. So sitting for 40 minutes might not be the most relaxing thing actually. You know, so there's a little contradiction here, this idea of, oh, I just meditate and then I will be relaxed. There are other ways to do it. So that is a little questionable, that approach. The other approach is like, oh, my life is really complicated. I'm kind of just retreat and strategize of how I go back. So it's kind of like using meditation as a way of just being like a little bit like a wild animal who's like, you know, watching its prey and then like jumps at the right time. So that's not relaxing, obviously, but it's also, when it's skillful in a way that at least you will be skillful in your activity, but because you haven't fully let go your activity, it's not quite what meditation is originally set out for, because if that all what the main intent of meditation would be, 2,500 years of just, you know, going into caves to strategize about the rest of my life, we should have figured out life by now. So it didn't quite work in that regard. So that's not quite the main focus of meditation either. Yeah, and the third one was just the idea of meditation being a sense of a cocoon. So you go in your, you know, period of meditation and figure out yourself and your life, and you come out like a butterfly, kind of. You figured it out. You have like way more skill sets that you learned in meditation. But even there, that's questionable, because you could just go to a therapist and talk with a therapist or have a life coach, and you might get even, you know, a lot of ideas there too. So meditation is not necessarily set out for that too. So just to highlight that this tradition of meditation is not necessarily just for calmness or just for strategizing. There are some elements to meditation that have been set out by those who, you know, suggested it over 2,000 years ago that we in our culture maybe have difficulty understanding yet, because it's so new. We're just, you know, we're in our consumerist culture, and we're like, you know, meditation. My doctor said I needed to do meditation, or it sounded good. So sometimes we might not fully understand why to do it, and yet we are drawn to it, which is sometimes a conundrum. So what is it mostly that the tradition is saying that meditation has as a benefit? In many ways, the tradition, the Buddhist tradition in particular, is talking about liberation. And that liberation is really from the inside of life is going in a circle. There's like circular patterns that we find ourselves in. And we just did a memorial service, and I do find that the contemplation about death are a helpful reminder on that. In particular, personally, I noticed in my 40s that I was just like really going around taking life in, you know, really trying to understand life. In my 40s, we're still at the end of, I'm realizing now it's like fading out, you know. There is like, I'm not interested in taking things in much anymore. I want to learn how to leave, because that's gonna really happen. Death is gonna happen, and I want to know how to die well. So there's like, seems a natural cycle there. So there's, in this way, our ancestors have been saying to us, you know, there is some movement here in life, a pattern that once we are aware of it, we can become more skillful with it. Yeah. So if you're not too caught up in this pattern, for example, pattern of, you know, establishing things, or you know, trying to create harmonious things or beneficial things, these are all well, but if you're like too caught up in them, then we might miss a larger pattern, which is, well, at one point we're going to die, and we need to be able to go through that gate of death. And that's what Buddhism in many ways have been using skillfully as a pointer of this larger pattern which we are living in. So sometimes this pattern is called samsara, because one of the big marks of these patterns that we live in is that it's painful, that there's dissatisfaction. And this sense of dissatisfaction can very much lead to more so dissatisfaction. So particularly if one is making all these efforts in lives, really trying all these things to improve oneself or to improve one's family or to improve one's country or whatever one is putting energy in. And then at one point just realizing death can come any moment, any time, and all these efforts are just being wiped out. They don't work out as we planned them to be. And so that's going to be very dissatisfying. And that's one of the main patterns the Buddha was saying, look guys, all this striving, all this wanting is really, really not going to help you, bottom line. So meditation is, yes, it's a stepping back and looking at that, but it's also wanting to look at the truth of this, the truth of impermanence, the truth that things are dissatisfactory. And he pointed something out that in particular, to this day, we are chewing on, particularly where Buddhism in this country is so new, which is like, things don't have a core. There's no core or internal own being to these things that we are engaging, including ourselves. And if we are chewing on this core, on chewing on this understanding, something will open up for us that frees us in the middle of our life in such a way that liberation is the word for that experience. And again, it's not an experience that's being created. The pointing out that I really like about it, it says it like this. Nothing whatsoever is to be. The nothing in your entire life needs to be removed. Not the slightest thing is to be added. Don't need to be improving. Truly looking at truth, truth is seen. So the activity of looking at truth, that's doing the job. When seen, this is complete liberation. So I say it, read it again. Nothing whatsoever is to be removed. Not the slightest thing is to be added. Truly looking at truth, truth is seen. When seen, this is complete liberation. So this instruction puts meditation very much in the ballpark of a very existential and very profound activity. We start off by, all these very good reasons. But there is a big promise here, and I feel this big promise is so big that naturally it takes some time. There's some investment that deserves us. If there's a liberation from any form of suffering, any form of discontent, any form of confusion, that's the promise, then yeah. Takes more than 40 minutes, and it it takes for more than a few years. It might take more than a lifetime, but ultimately there is a big encouragement that we can see in this lifetime. That there's a matter of really looking. It's a matter of truly looking at truth. So, and here, of course, I want to stop and see if you have any questions about that.
So when you asked why do you meditate, and so I was asking myself this question as well, and the answer for myself was that I'm convinced that the Buddha's teachings are true, and by meditating I can reach truth, and that is why I meditate. But then the other question arose was that and that we have seen in the sutras, like Buddha talks about, like in the Diamond Sutra, that ultimately all beings will be led to the Nirvana by the Buddha. And And then just like researching other religions, like Christianity or Sikhism or Hinduism, I've come to the conclusion also that they are also talking about the same thing. It's like in a different cultural context. And in like our last session where we played Coburn's talk, and he was talking about Jesus, and he was also saying that like what was really great about Jesus was his relationship to the Absolute. And so it seems like these teachings are all true, and so many great teachers can't be talking about something that's false. So given that it is true, like my question is that, let's say all beings are liberated, and we've seen that, you know, 2000 years ago Buddha came and the Dharma has spread, right? There's 500 million people practicing the Dharma. It's everywhere and it's growing.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's say all beings are liberated.
Mm-hmm.
Will that mean there'll be like no humans anymore because they're free from birth and death?
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean there's not going to be any beings on earth?
Mm-hmm.
And is that a good thing?
Mm-hmm.
So that's my question.
Thank you, appreciate it. First of all, I want to differentiate. I feel like there is definitely an overlap between the different traditions, but language makes such a huge difference. Whatever language we use, whatever word we use, can absolutely turn on our mind, right? Like saying blue versus saying red. You either feel cold or feel warm. There is like an effect there. The different traditions definitely are trying on truth and have saying statements that are related to truth, because how could they not? There's nothing but truth, you know. And truth, I mean, not capital T, but truth in the sense of experiential truth. Because if we get into truth, capital T, like truth being a noun, truth being something that's concrete, then we like, you know, getting into all these tensions, because then we're like, hey, wait a minute, I'm seeing truth like this, and you're saying truth like this, and the tension can come up because it's this object out there. And the same is when you're saying, talking about beings. Yes, if beings are really realized and liberated, that can be a true, it is a true statement. However, it's also medicine. And for example, if you're using the medicine right now, you're walking through life and you're saying, oh, all beings are already liberated and everything I see is just an enlightened display of awakening, of truth. But you're not fully understanding that truth or not fully understanding what liberation means. Then particularly not understanding what beings mean, because you're still thinking being is a human or being is a person or being is an individual creature that's being born and that dies. Then there's still, you're separating the ultimate and the relative. So long as there's some separation between that which is ultimately true and that which is relatively appearing to us, which is birth and death, so long there is some separation there and something that feels different to us, that long we are not ready for the medicine of saying, oh, we are liberated. You know what I'm saying? Everything has its time. We cannot drink down all the teachings at the same time, at the very beginning. Sometimes you have to build up. What does it mean? You know, what does liberation really mean? Linger on that a little longer, and then you might understand what it means that all beings are really liberated.
Sorry, I didn't get one part of your answer.
Yeah.
So if all beings are liberated from the cycle of birth and death, so does that not mean that there will be no more birth?
Well, the being has to know that it's liberated. If the being doesn't know it's not liberated, it's not liberated.
Yes.
That's where we keep looking at our mind and see. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and understanding meditation, even though there's no specific goal or a sense of like like a merchant's mind trying to get something. Is there an understanding, from your understanding of Buddhism, is there an understanding of like of basic goodness, or what I call Buddha nature, or basic goodness that is, you might say, potentially available from the meditation experience?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, ultimately, and that's a beauty. Let me see. That's the beauty of the fact of you seeking meditation, or seeking looking at your mind, or wanting to know more about liberation, or what, how they work and so forth, that there is a circle there, or a good news there. So what Michael is just bringing up is the Buddha nature, our true being, our originally pure true mind. That's the basis of our being, is our mind. And that's also called the Buddha element. Like, it's our mind free from any forms of grasping, any forms of conceptualizing, any forms of seeking. So this Buddha nature, or Buddha element, it says, if this Buddha nature would not be there, there would also be no remorse over suffering. But because we are suffering, and because we like don't like it, this is proof that you are having this true mind, the liberation already in you. And because it's already there, liberation will be available, and it will be available in this lifetime if you keep looking for it. And the process is, I mean, this is language, right? And language makes it kind of harder, because now I'm saying there's a Buddha, a true mind of yours, of ours. And it's covered like the sun with clouds. Or the other image is like, it's like a golden statue that's wrapped in rags. What are the rags? The rags are like everything that's ready to be discarded, right? Something that we want to discard, that we want to get rid of. Things that we really don't like. In this quote, if the Buddha element weren't present, there would be no remorse over suffering. If we wouldn't have this aversion towards our suffering, there wouldn't be no liberation, right? That's what you were saying. That there is our wanting liberation is already a sign of our liberation. Our wanting being free of suffering for ourselves or others is already a huge sign of knowing that we can be free of suffering, knowing that that this is extra. This is something that we can let go of. And what is suffering again? It's like any form of grasping, mine, yours. This should be different than what it is. I want something that's not here. So these forms of these formations, or these patterns in our mind, they can be let go of. And that's when we let go of them, then we are seeing clearly that, you know, it's nothing needs to be added, nothing needs to be removed. It's a paradox, and I feel in this paradoxical realm, that's where the not to can come forward naturally. Go ahead.
How do you answer the question of, this is something I want, like desire, and this is something I crave, versus something, this is something that I need to live my life, you know? Because people like earn money to have like sustenance, right? They want food and shelter.
Right.
At what point does that become like craving?
Right.
Like, I want more.
Right.
I want a bigger house. I want a car.
Very good question. Yeah, absolutely. Traditionally,
Could we ask if you can repeat questions?
Oh, absolutely. I apologize. So the question of what's your name again?
Shoban.
Was about, well, how do we know how when we know our like basically our naturally needing to have housing or having food or having certain sustenance, our basic needs, when does it turn into a craving? Like when are we actually just engaging in a pattern that's obstructing our true nature? You could say like that. So when does it? And it's interesting that traditionally that's where the Buddha put forth the Vinaya rules, which are very much training the body to the body activity to not engage in any of these activities that would ask, because it is a slippery rope. You know, if you need food, it's a natural thing, and I totally encourage you to ask your neighbor if they have any food, because that's a, you know, you need it. But when does it go into craving? Nobody from the outside would be able to tell it. It's only you yourself who would ever know, I'm really craving it, and I, you know, and craving is kind of like in that form, a form of tension, like truly knowing it can't go without. And so the rules that the Buddha set forth was, well, why don't you explore if you really can go without? Like, why don't you try out how that would be? And the forms of renunciation that are like developed over time, because not everybody has, at that time, there was a social agreement in which he was able to do that, where people were really admiring anybody wanting to explore their daily sustenance to come on a really hand-to-mouth basis. We are not living in that society. So, and other Asian cultures didn't have that either. So, for example, in China and so forth, monks just like, okay, let's hold that back, and there's more trouble I'm not getting into. They just grew their own food, for example. They just cut that out traditionally as a form of, we have to do it different here. So there is some change around this training aspect. What I learned in my training and in Tibetan cultures is that ultimately what it comes down to, this lack of craving or knowing that you're not craving and you wish or wanting something, is that you really have a form of disgust for samsara. So so first of all, it's really knowing what samsara is, which is these patterns of greed, hate, and delusion. And then really having a form of disgust towards that. Like some really genuine sense of like, me trying to get lunch is too, it's like, it's, that's, there's more to life than that. It's like a true knowing that there's more to our being than lunch, for example. And then lunch might still come, but you really weren't looking for it, you, because you knew you could, you know. Or even if you were to like sometimes one of my teachers, he was really doing for 3 years, going out doing the begging in India. And he was like, normally always something comes. Like he really made that experience that if you generally just set your mind on meditation, the sustenance and your needs will be fulfilled. So that's one way of, you know, letting go of it and not craving, because he was just like so immersed in this liberation project that he was just trusting that it would come, and it did. And he told a story, one day he was sitting and nothing came. And he sat a whole day with no food, and then he was really hungry, but he had some money on him because people gave him money instead of food. So he went to the next restaurant and ate. And made it, an experience about how it is to break a fast, and then that's why he was telling the story. So, not kind of like Okay, it's absolutely that you just set your mind on liberation and everything will fall into place. It's not that easy because there's maybe like some different learning that needs to happen. But that switch over, and that can really happen in a lot of circumstances. And sometimes if our life is too complex, we really need to find a way to simplify it, because you can't necessarily generate the disgust for samsara if you're immersed in like a load of activities where you can't help yourself in order to fulfill your schedule like that. So it's a lifestyle where you're not constantly demanded to respond. Does this make sense? I think that's why really being the friends we have, bottom line, it's really who are the people we're hanging out with that help us see this inner, are we craving or are we really just trusting?
Yeah. I just want to follow up. So thank you for your answer. I think it makes a lot of sense in theory.
Mm-hmm.
Would you have any tips for people who are out there in the materialistic world to develop a path towards reaching the state where you're not craving anything, put it into practice?
So first of all, find the friends who want the same thing and hang out with them. And from there, find a way to put the first thing on your schedule that is listening to teachings. Because the more you listen to teachings, the more this inner wisdom comes naturally. So in Buddhism, there's three forms of wisdom. The first is listening. You listen to teachings, take in teachings. Then you contemplate the teachings. You what's being said? What is ringing with me? What do I want to adopt? What do I need to reject? And then the wisdom of realization is like, this is my way forward. This is what you need to do. I feel I personally feel it's difficult to just find our way, just in America quite yet, because so many Dharma centers are here being able to provide teachings, but they're not necessarily able to provide large communities. I think this is still growing, and I wouldn't want to give up on it. I think these places are happening, there's still some growing pain there. Also financially, people haven't quite fully, the donors for those places haven't quite fully, come forward. So in order to grow in that, it might take a little while. I personally found great encouragement by going to Asia a little bit and really be around my teachers and sanghas and communities over there, because they have a 2,000-year experience, and it's really incredibly inspiring to see how the integration of liberation and daily life is being manifested. And it's just really hard to find in this culture. There are places, but they're smaller. So between listening, contemplating, and then realizing your own way forward,
Just thinking about how that's a very beautiful ideal, what you're speaking of, and I think you're speaking of more of a monastic path about being out of rules and begging for food, but the Buddha taught householders and monastics different ways of living, and maybe nobody here is actually on a monastic path in that traditional sense. So I don't know, stepping down the highest ideal to what is craving, how do we work with craving in a householder life, when it's not, we're not begging for food and so on, brings up more questions for me.
No, I appreciate that. Yeah.
I really loved your answer for several reasons, because one of the things that came to mind when you asked the question, it relates to what you were saying too, because that Buddha, of course, provided teachings for all the questions that we have here. But it's not, it's, there seem to be, in my personal experience, two issues. One is that we can't just read philosophy. We think we can, but we need community, and we need people who will support us because we will, A, fool ourselves, and B, there's a lot of condensed wisdom. But like the Maha Satipatthana Sutta, okay, sometimes people don't even read the mindfulness sutras, but they think they're practicing mindfulness, but he specifically addresses where craving disappears at the end of the Maha Satipatthana Sutta. And he's saying that it's right there. So right now, when you're looking at me, that I is where the craving can be eliminated. So it's in the experiences that you're having when you're eating the food is the place where the craving could be liberated. But we need our friends and our teachers to unpack, you know, it's right there, right? So even if we're lay people, we need how these questions come up, as you were saying, because the teachings are there, but how do we practice? It's almost to say, like, the teachings are kind of simple, but we don't do it. There's a way. Because, you know, if you look at where even advanced, very, very advanced yogis began, this basic compassion, calming the mind, and, but that's where the liberation can happen, even in our daily life.
Were you able to hear some of this? I'm not sure I can summarize it. Okay. Yeah.
I just wanted to add that I mean, the hard truth is we live in a culture of acquisition, and it's pervasive, and I mean, the stores and our monetary system and the sense of, you know, that sense is like, we have to acknowledge that that's our environment. And those of us that are meditators, those of us that do this meditation process, you know, whether we do it a lot or whether we do it a little, as we go out into the world, as we meet the world, I would recommend a little bit of what I might call a guerrilla warfare. In other words, like, sabotage, you could say, this acquisition environment, this greed environment, with a little, you know, bring into it a little bit of your meditation mind. And some people throughout the day, even though they're working or they're busy, you know, with all this kind of cultural stuff or work or everything, they find techniques of just for just a moment or two, kind of checking in with their breath and remembering their big mind or something like that, so that they can come back to this Buddha mind that, you know, that we experience in meditation. You can. In your daily life, and even in your shopping, you know, when you're thinking about buying something, you can bring your practice everywhere. But it takes a little work. So you can be a little saboteur or a guerrilla warrior, you could say, in this world of greed, and bring a peaceful mind into it.
Yeah. I heard the bells, and when Mike was speaking, I was reminded of the slogan of turn on, tune in, drop out. So what it means in this context right now, I would think that really, you know, let's be friends and let really help each other. Remember the vacant mind. Remember that there's something that is really so incredibly precious that any of these activities that so enticing can be low. Doesn't mean they're gone completely. I don't think there won't be any humans gone any second. One image, I think, to retell the story a little bit, and I'm really trying to close here, is in this simile that I heard with a king who wanted to see everybody. He wanted to have all humans, all beings, all creatures. He wanted to see them. And of course, he or she set up a condition in order to make that happen. And the condition was, you have 2 hours, which is, I can say it's our lifespan. It's like really short. You have 100 years, you have 2 hours, you have a certain set, a limited time span in order to see this king. And so everybody like, let's go. And they go. And then there's a room there with really good food, or a room with like incredibly good company. And you go in those rooms and you forget your time. So the story here is to be like, there's a king to be seen. There's, and the king is nothing else but your mind. And we have this limited time span. So let's find the company that helps you, you know, make that experience happen. That experience that's so precious and so incredibly beneficial, not only for you, but for everybody. Everybody around you, everybody on this planet, there's like a deep benefit in there. And so therefore, there's nothing whatsoever to remove. It's one description of this mind. Not the slightest thing to be added. That's one description of our mind. The king, truly looking, truth is seen. When seen, this is complete liberation. Thank you for your practice. Thanks for coming here today.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.